on pop culture and politics. This is The Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day when I don't think you have to be a Republican or a conservative or any kind of Trump supporter to recognize that President Trump got some pretty tough treatment by the press. Now, some of it he deserved, but generally the idea of him constantly attacking what he called the fake news and fake media and saying they were corrupt and they were dishonest and they're liars, that didn't help so much, or did it? There is now a leading establishment press figure, Dana Milbank, a columnist and reporter for the Washington Post, who says, wait a minute, you can actually run the numbers, do a test, do an analysis, and Joe Biden is getting worse treatment by the press than Donald Trump. Now, that sounds wrong to me, but we'll talk about it with Dana Milbank coming up this hour on The Medved Show. Is it true that Joe Biden is breaking all records in terms of negative press treatment? And what has the president done specifically to encourage that? There's an answer that might surprise you from Dana Milbank. We will get to that coming up on The Medved Show. I also want to speak about a passionate piece by an emergency room doctor in Michigan about the filled hospital beds and the very, very difficult times he has right now with the upsurge and the onrushing Omicron variant and so many things going on with COVID-19 that are not the end of the pandemic, and what he believes can be done about it. We will get to that as well on The Medved Show. But first up, there's a fascinating little side note to that big Wall Street Journal poll that I've been talking about that suggests that Republicans almost certainly are going to win back the House of Representatives. They stand a huge advantage for 2022, and if they nominate someone who's electable, for 2024 for the presidency. So what's the one big point that Democrats are putting their hopes on? It's the idea that they expect that the Supreme Court of the United States in June or July, when they announce their decision right in the midst of the election, that the Supreme Court is going to pare back the current very open abortion laws, where basically Roe v. Wade has made it impossible for states to go ahead and block access to abortion except in the very last stages of pregnancy. So they believe that abortion is going to be the magic elixir that brings the Democrats back from not the dead, but back from the possibility of really crushing defeats coming up. Is that true? Well, there's a fascinating and a very well done and very balanced piece at 538, and it's by a writer named Amelia Thompson DeVoe, so you can say it's a woman, right? There it is. And she writes, ask Americans whether Roe should be overturned, and the answer seems pretty straightforward. Polls consistently find that a majority think the Supreme Court should keep the ruling in place. But Americans' views on abortion are hardly clear-cut. Majorities also support a variety of restrictions on abortion, including limits on abortion in the second trimester that openly conflict with the Supreme Court's rulings, which shouldn't be surprising. Most people, if you wanted to find out from them, what do you think that Roe actually does, what do you think the holding of Roe is, they wouldn't know that even under Roe, you are allowed to use that standard of viability and viability at the time of Roe was defined as about 28 weeks, that to restrict abortion after the pregnancy's gone on for a while, for 28 weeks. And what Amelia DeVoe says in this piece is that she actually puts together a great collection of data on public opinion and shows where it really stands. And this is fascinating to me, because it's very different from what a lot of pro-life people think. It's very, very different from what most pro-choice people think. Most pro-choice people think we win on this one. This one's a winning issue for us, for meaning pro-choice people. Well, it's not. Overall perspectives on abortion, she writes, tend to fall into three main camps. The first camp is a relatively small chunk of Americans, which comes to about 15%, who think abortion should be illegal in every case. In other words, no abortion very early in pregnancy, no abortion late in pregnancy, doesn't matter when it is. People, about 15% of Americans, say they're opposed to abortion in any circumstance. Then there's a second camp, which is also a minority, about 30%, not 15%, who want abortion to be legal in every case. An abortion at just hours before birth, yeah, that's okay with them. They're in favor of abortion in every case. So what do you have? You have a minority, 15%, who say no abortion ever, 30% who say yes, abortion whenever people want it, but a heavy majority, about 65%, who fall into a gray area, telling pollsters that they want abortion to be legal in some or most cases, but not all. That final character category is all over the place, she says, as it includes both people who think abortion should be legal only in cases of rape, incest, and when the mother's life is at risk, as well as people who think abortion should be legal with only limited restrictions, perhaps for minors or for abortions in later stages of pregnancy. It may be hard to know how most people really feel about abortion, but one important takeaway from this data is that the vast majority of Americans, somewhere between 85% and 90%, according to polls, multiple polls, think abortion should be legal in at least some circumstances. Total bans on abortion, which have now passed in three states, are popular only with a small sliver of the public. But here's the other thing that is crucial to understand, and if you're talking about the politics of abortion, it's directly relevant. And what they find out is they interview people with these various opinions and opinion groups, and they interview somebody who is named Amanda. She's 38 years old. She says, I lean more toward the pro-life side of things, and I don't think abortion is something that should just be available to everyone all the time. But I also don't like how everyone is so extreme, she said. What people are looking for is the kind of abortion rules that apply in most other countries in the world. And the other fascinating thing here is how unimportant people think this issue is. Very few people who list abortion as the number one issue. And why is that important? Well, politically, it means all the difference and argues even more for a moderate position. And what about Joe Biden? He claims to be a moderate, but he's getting slammed by every aspect of the media. Why? We'll talk to Dana Milbank of The Washington Post coming up. Jeremy, is that Burl Ives? Burl Ives it is. When I was a little kid, my mom got me a Burlives record, which had all kinds of fun songs on it. And, of course, this song, not quite Bing Crosby, but well worth listening to. And somebody else who's worth listening to, because even when he's dead wrong, he's provocative and he writes so well, is Dana Milbank of the Washington Post, who is a nationally syndicated op-ed columnist, and he provides political commentary for various TV outlets as well, and the author of three books on politics, including the national bestseller Homo Politicus, about political man, obviously. Dana, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show again.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You have a headline that's highly provocative, and I couldn't resist. The headline, "The Media Treat Biden as Badly as or Worse than Trump." Here's proof. Okay, deliver the proof.
Well, I delivered it because I provided all the data. So what I did was had this AI firm, it's called Fiscal Note. They use something called Forge Artificial Intelligence. And they do sentiment analysis. This is what you typically do. You know, investment groups do this to see where things are headed on various corporations, for example. So we said, well, let's apply it to the press coverage. So they took in 200,000 articles from 65 publications, you know, tens of millions of words. And it analyzes, you know, the adjectives in stories, where they're placed in the story, the proximity to the president's name, and it gives different weight to different you know, types of descriptions in the story. And so what it found was, if you look at the last 4 months, August, September, October, and November, the coverage, the sentiment, the coverage of Biden was as negative, and at times, largely in August, worse than the coverage of Trump was in those same 4 months last year. And, you know, that was a, you know, a time when, first of all, the pandemic, the threats not to honor the results of the election, and ultimately not honoring the results of the election, and, you know, the Proud Boys and QAnon, all of that was going on then. So, you know, this is looking at the media as a whole. I know that various outlets will say, hey, not me, not me. And, it, you know, the truth is it's not really a problem of one outlet or another, but it is actually, you know, true, at least according to this analysis, that we collectively are more negative on Biden, or at least as negative.
Does that reflect the fact that Biden has not quite been as grabby of press attention? There was also far more attention to Trump as president than there has been to Joe Biden, who doesn't come out and argue with reporters every day.
Right. That's the, and that's another thing they found. In fact, there's literally twice as much coverage as Trump as there has been of Biden. So I think part of it may be that there's a vacuum there. You know, Trump drove a lot of the coverage, you know, with the manic tweeting, and, you know, it's a new topic every day that would send us chasing our tail. So I think that is part of it. But I also think that, you know, the media haven't really calibrated for this new reality, what I would call it, when we, you know, we have real, you know, actual threats to democracy underway. So I think we're, you know, in the media, we're being just as negative and saying, hey, you know, Biden, you know, botched the pullout from Afghanistan, or Biden can't get his, you know, social infrastructure bill through. We're being just about the same amount of negativity as we were showing when saying, President Trump is trying to overthrow a free and fair election. So obviously, you know, one of those things is far weightier than the others, but we seem to be have gone back in the media to, you know, a traditional role for us, and that is, you know, being the adversarial press, looking for conflict. But, you know, my argument is we are kind of living in a different time now.
Do you think that part of this is a conscious attempt, or maybe just below conscious attempt, to make up for all of the attacks on fake news and biased media, and to show, well, hey, look at this. We're going to slam Biden, and mm-hmm. he's certainly been a sort of juicy target. And then people can't look back on us and say we were unfair to Trump.
I think that is one of the things that's at play. And, you know, that it's sort of like working the refs. You know, you get called the enemy of the people so many times you want to prove that you're not the enemy of the people. So I do think that's a factor going on. There are other factors as well. There's no secret that readership, viewership, listenership, it's all off since the Trump time. Trump was really good for business. So what do you replace that with? Well, usually, you remember the old line, if it bleeds, it leads. So, you know, bad news, conflict, that's what traditionally has generated eyeballs and ears in the past. So I think we're sort of, whether deliberately or subconsciously, doing that bit of that as well.
Let me ask you something else that has mystified me. I am a very, very big non-fan of Vice President Harris, but mm-hmm. she's been so kind of invisible and below the surface. There's tremendous opposition to her. She has a by far lower approval rating than President Biden. What's the deal with Vice President Harris, who isn't even in the news that much?
No, and when she is, it's about AirPods or something or other. That's kind of the problem every vice president has, and she was done no favors by Biden, giving her, portfolios like, the border, like, wait, where's the upside in that one? I think that's part of it, the invisibility. So, we talked about the vacuum. Around Biden, I think it's an even greater one. So that certainly the people who don't like her or her critics will have the, an ability to crowd out whatever other coverage there would be.
If you were talking to President Biden or say to the chief of staff, Ron Klain, what would you say? What can he do to improve his press coverage?
Well, you know what? If I were advising President Biden, I can assure you he'd be in worse shape today than he is. I would begin by saying they definitely shouldn't listen to me. I think you need to keep talking about this and saying these times are not normal. Our democracy is under threat. We've got to do something about this. The facts matter.
The problem with is, do you tend to blame the guy who's in charge? Dana Milbank, I actually think it'd be interesting to see what happened if you were in charge for a while. It would certainly be a test for any journalist. Appreciated Dana's column in the Washington Post about Biden versus Trump and the media. And check it out. It'll be at our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back.
Busy sidewalks, dressed in holiday style. In the air, there's a feeling of Christmas. Children laughing.
The ageless and incomparable Tony Bennett. And certainly somebody who has added to the joys of the season for many, many, many years. What is remarkable today is how many people and it's something to be thankful for, actually survive up into their 90s and beyond. One of the things that has been remarkable too is that there's so much publicity about how people who are older are more vulnerable to being seriously ill, hospitalized, or dead because of COVID-19. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that the majority of Americans, particularly if they take reasonable precautions, have survived and, God willing, will continue to survive this pandemic. Now, it's true that they now say 50 million Americans, 50 million have tested positive, have had COVID-19. And of those 50 million, a not insubstantial percentage have died. We're now 788,000 as of, I think, last week. There's a piece in the New York Times by an emergency room doctor in Michigan who writes about some of the difficulty that he has keeping his spirits up and treating people who come in with the pandemic and without vaccinations. He says, recently a patient in his 70s came seeking care at the small rural hospital in western Michigan where I've worked as an emergency room physician for 2 decades. He had tested positive for the coronavirus earlier in the week. He was now running a high fever and struggled to breathe. When asked if he had been vaccinated, he snapped back, "I don't approve of the vaccine." A few days later, a young patient sick with COVID-19 was admitted with dangerously low blood oxygen. His spouse and infant child came in to say goodbye just before he was sedated and intubated. "I don't think I'll see you again," he said to them. He died before the end of the week. He was unvaccinated. As of last Monday, 9 hospitals in Michigan were 100% full, and at least 20 others were at or above 90% capacity. Statewide, nearly 1 in 4 hospital patients has a confirmed or suspected case of COVID-19. Now, that's remarkable. You're talking about all the people in all the hospitals in this major state, and 1 in 4 who's in the hospital is there for COVID-19. In the last few weeks, my hospital has been consistently at or near capacity, and nearly every day, the vast majority of those patients are sick with COVID-19. Nearly all, he says, have been unvaccinated. In a small hospital, our patients are our neighbors, friends, and old high school classmates. The profound sadness of failing to save a life hits us every time. Familiarity deepens our sadness, but more and more we feel frustrated and angry. Losing a patient is never easy. Losing one so senselessly when the death could have been avoided with a free, safe, and effective vaccine is devastating, writes Dr. Robertson. He goes on, says, "I often feel full of trauma, guilt, and despair. I'm mad at news personalities and politicians who downplay vaccination. I'm frustrated with people who aren't doing more to protect themselves and their loved ones. Sometimes I'm just mad with a kind of seething, aimless anger. But even on the hardest days, I box my emotions and get back to the work of caring for patients because I made a commitment to heal people, not hold grudges. On some shifts," he writes, "the stress in the air is palpable. My colleagues and I know the patients are piling up, but there just are not enough nurses to properly triage everyone." He goes on, and it's a powerful piece, and you can imagine how someone in that position would feel. He also predicts that as immunity from vaccinations wanes, because now they are saying that to be fully vaccinated, you really need a third vaccine, a booster, and that's only a small number of Americans who've actually gotten all 3 vaccines. As immunity from vaccinations wanes, infections will most likely increase. If a persistently large number of people remain unvaccinated, and you could add to that, or resist getting the booster shot that's been so strongly recommended, a vaccine mandate is the only way to break the endless cycle of surging infections that in turn push hospitals to the brink and to save lives, particularly in a conservative community like mine, where COVID-19 misinformation is pervasive and death rates are far higher than in other communities. Now, look, there's been some good news about drugs that have been developed not as vaccines or an alternative to vaccinations, but for people who do test positive. A drug tested by Merck, which, when it is approved, when it is ready, is supposed to reduce your chances of death by at least 30%, and a much better drug that would probably take a little bit longer to get approved by Pfizer that could have a 90% ability, which would change everything in this country and would really allow us to get back to normal. If you knew that taking the proper course of an approved drug could actually reduce your chances of the most serious consequences by 90%, wouldn't that be remarkable? But the point about this is, what I find incredibly depressing is the attempt to politicize everything. When the basic idea has to be not just what can you do for an individual patient, but what can you do for the vast group of Americans, where clearly having a group of people in your area where you live who are fully vaccinated with even that third vaccine, that booster vaccine, that can make a very real difference. And there are so many sad stories. There's one that I haven't talked about yet, but it's a guy named Marcus Lamb, who was a founder of the Texas-based Christian television network Daystar, who had been dismissive of COVID-19 vaccines. He died last week after contracting the coronavirus at age 64. His wife, Joni Lamb, confirmed the death on Ministry Now, the show that she and Mr. Lamb had hosted together. After contracting the virus, Mr. Lamb, who frequently suggested on the air that people pray instead of getting inoculated, was taken to a hospital when his oxygen levels dropped all of a sudden, his wife said in a broadcast on in November. It was not immediately clear when he had tested positive for the virus. Daystar Television Network, which the Lambs founded in 1997, did not respond for requests for comment. It is terribly sad, and I find it very sad and depressing, frankly, that people have put together basically websites, a listing, all of the people who have been very publicly opposed to vaccines, like Marcus Lamb, and then the terrible way that they have suffered. The non-suffering is not guaranteed. Safety and survival, never guaranteed, but certainly far more likely for everyone in this great nation. We will be right back on the MedVet Show. Christmas wishes out there for everybody. There's a great idea and an easy idea for giving a Christmas present that will give back to whoever is lucky enough to receive it for the entire course of a year. I'm talking about a MedHead Plus membership, because that way, for your payment of 22 cents a day, it's not a lot of money. The recipient of that gift, it may be getting it for yourself, will have access to the MedVet History Store with literally close to 100 titles now. You can check it out. Go to MedVetHistoryStore.com and see what's on offer. And also access to this show 24/7, anytime. And it's free and commercial-free once you join as a MedHead Plus member. And yes, you can give a gift subscription. Go to the MedVedHistoryStore.com or just to MichaelMedVed.com and join us as a MedHead Plus member. Now, this is not exactly making history, but it's a reflection of a long history. I don't want to go into my grudges against Stanford University right now, but this is an interesting story, because apparently they have a tradition that has been going on for a long time. It's associated with what they call the big game. The big game for Stanford is the Stanford, what they call them now, the Cardinal. Used to, of course, be the Indians. It's the Cardinal versus the Golden Bears of University of California at Berkeley. Around that big game, they have a naked run, which is part of a long campus tradition. But this year, the naked run will feature runners who are not completely in the nude. Now, this is not some kind of moralistic response to change a long tradition of nudity. The reason that people will not be fully in the nude is because the university has required that the people taking place in the naked run, even though the rest of their bodies can be naked, their faces have to be covered with masks. Yeah, they're saying that this is a race that everyone wins, I guess, and you should stay safe. The naked run is an old tradition that occurs as part of the annual pep rally hosted by the university's Ramshead Theatrical Society. The Stanford Review reports that ahead of this year's event, students received an email from one of the show's producers informing them that masks are mandatory, and they could wear as little clothes as they want, just as long as they kept in mind that the mouth, nose has to be carefully covered. And I don't think you pin the award, but you can pin it on the mask. Maybe that's the way to do it. You pin the award on the mask, or you just have the gold medal or whatever it is on a ribbon, something like that, which you could tie on, well, or just around the neck or whatever. Meanwhile, there's a political statement where the a candidate for lieutenant governor who had already announced his candidacy, he was gathering some money, he was planning to run. It's a former Republican who had become a Democrat, and this is in the state of Texas. And Matt Dowd, who was part of the Bush political team, is no longer, as I say, identifies as a Republican. He became a Democrat, but now he's no longer identifying as a candidate. He put on Twitter, "A diverse field is now emerging in the Democratic primary for this office," Dowd said. "I do not want to be the one who stands in the way of the greater diversity we need in politics. Important news, I am ending my campaign for Lieutenant Governor of Texas. Aw. Now that the race is emerging in a more diverse way, I have made the decision from a place of integrity to step back." I hate it when politicians try to point out their own integrity. Wouldn't it be better if you let other people point out it? Because this is not integrity. In other words, what he is saying is the ultimate racist assumption, is that I thought I would be the best possible candidate Texas could have for lieutenant governor, but now because there are other people who have a different skin shade than me, I'm standing aside because we need people with different skin shade. He wrote a piece, an op-ed for ABC News 2 years ago that they're now bringing out. In his op-ed, he said, "As a white male Christian in America, I am part of a dwindling subset that has held the levers of power politically and economically in nearly every field for the entire history of the United States." Added at that point, "And though my Irish Catholic ancestors had to push to get a seat at the table, we are still part of this dominant power group. Yes, the halls of power have slowly let in some people of color, women, people of a different faith, and people of a different sexual persuasion, but white male Christians still dominate the rooms where most decisions are made." What's unbelievable to me is I would ask Matt Dowd, do you think about yourself as a member of a group? because you're white and male? Do you respond better? Do you have more friendships with people because they're white or male? Would you pick a friend just because he was or was not white or male? I would submit that judging your own suitability for office based upon your race is just as obnoxious and just as outrageous as ruling out some other candidate because of his or her race, whatever that happens to be. What a foolish thing. And speaking of foolish things, there is a movie right now which takes a very, very negative view of the Catholic Church and of religion in general. And it's so gross and graphic that it isn't even rated officially. Listen to this review from the maker of Showgirls.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
83-year-old director Paul Verhoeven is no stranger to controversy. In the past, he's made films like Total Recall, RoboCop, Basic Instinct, and the reviled Showgirls. Now he's back with what could be the most explosive film of his career so far. A French language epic about a lesbian nun who's tormented by erotic visions about figures from the Bible. It's called Benedetta, and it's now playing with subtitles in theaters across the country. Belgian actress Virginie Efira has the embarrassing task of trying to bring to life Sister Benedetta Carlini, an Italian girl in the early 1600s whose fantasies and prophecies attracted a wide following before the church condemned her as heretical. This cheesy film reaches for disturbing but achieves only disgusting. There's no official rating, but it would be NC-17. 1.5 stars for Benedetta, a certified must-miss. And honestly, it's one of those films that if you look at the reviews don't give you any sense of what you're about to see. And the film includes a crucifixion scene in her visions that is sexualized. And it is deeply offensive. And it recycles virtually all of the most toxic anti-Catholic stereotypes you could possibly put in it. Charlotte Rampling, who's a pretty versatile actress and a veteran actress, gives a tolerable performance, but the Virginie Efira, the lead character, can't act worth anything, and you can even tell that with the subtitles. This is not a film I can recommend. And the fact that they're releasing it at Christmas season, well, at least they didn't release it at Easter time, I guess. Okay, talking about being releasing, Arthur Herman is a brilliant strategic thinker at the Hudson Institute. He says, right now we're in trouble unless we develop new hypersonic capability. The Chinese are moving ahead of us. We'll talk to him. We'll talk to another general, General Kellogg, who was part of the Trump military advisors, Trump White House, talks about what exactly we need to do to deal with Iran against the world, China against Taiwan, Russia against Ukraine, all demanding action from this greatest nation on God's green earth.